hits me, oh my gosh, this is that triangle.
You know, there's explanation for everything that occurred in the Rendlesham Forest incident that doesn't involve aliens at all.
It was completely silent. It comes right over our heads.
It's so a classic flying saucer, really, standing in the clearing.
He turned over to my father and held his hand, and he looked in his eyes and said, "We're not alone."
Welcome to Podcast UFO for our live show. We're live every Wednesday at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Dark Matter Radio Network. Please remember to visit the website podcastufo.com for past episodes, blogs, and forums. During the show, feel free to participate live in our chat room. And don't forget to like us on our very active Facebook page.
Hello, everyone. This is Martin Willis. I'm your host, and I'm super excited about tonight's show. Can you believe we have both Colonel Charles Hault and John Burroughs of the Rendlesham Forest incident in the same show together? Amazing. Before that, we have Alejandro Rojas, of course, from Open Minds Radio to talk about the latest UFO events. If you've missed the last few shows, let me fill you in on some changes. You can listen live for free for 2 hours every Wednesday night right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. But only the first hour will be made into a free podcast on podcastufo.com, Stitcher, iTunes, and all that. Subscribers will be able to access the whole show, including the second hour, as a podcast on getjoyride.com/podcastufo. The link, don't worry about that long URL, the link is right on our website. Subscribers pay only $1 a month or more to access the full two-hour show. And that's right there on that website. This will give you a private link for iTunes and other media players. And I know there's a few thousand regular listeners on Stitcher. I'm not really sure what I'm going to do about that. If you have any questions, problems, or concerns, please email me at martin@podcastufo.com. We had a few glitches last week, but things seem to work out. If you haven't contacted me and you're still having a glitch, please do. The company, getjoyride.com, is very concerned with making this a real smooth process for all. So far, it's going pretty well. All righty, and now we're ready for Alejandro Rojas from Open Minds TV. How you doing, Alejandro?
Hey, I am doing very well. Good to talk to you again, my friend.
You bet. Hey, you know, I was thinking about when I come out there for the UFO Congress to see you. How far away are you from the Grand Canyon?
From the Grand Canyon, about 4 or 5 hours.
Oh.
So it's a little bit of a jaunt. I've done a day trip, and it was fun because really, I don't know, it was actually my first trip. I'm like, you know, one weekend, I'm going to the Grand Canyon. I'm going to drive out there early, see how long it takes, and then come back. I don't mind driving at night. Went out there, walked around for 3-4 hours, had dinner, and it was more than enough. I got the gist, and I came back home. So, I mean, if you wanted to add another day to visit the canyon, it's doable.
Yep. You know, I've stopped there a couple of times, but I never really did much. Like, you know, I know people go down on the donkeys and all that stuff. Do they still do all that?
I don't know. I think they do, yeah. I heard a story recently about that, so I think that they do.
I'm not interested in it, but it sounds good.
I like looking at it, and that's cool. It's scary, and people do fall off. And I've heard more stories living in Arizona. Quite a few people fall off, I guess, because there's like no rails or anything.
Are you talking about the end? They fall off the donkeys?
No, they fall into the canyon.
Oh, they just fall in when they're around the edge.
I'm sure they fall off the donkeys. I did. I went to Mexico, March? And we did a donkey ride, and those things will – this group, what we had, they were competing with each other. So they would try to run in front to be first, and you could easily fall off those damn donkeys.
Can you get donkey insurance?
But they're fun.
Yeah. Wow. That's amazing.
They've got personality.
Yeah, they do.
I'm sure you can. You can get practically every type of insurance.
Lloyd's of London.
Yep.
All right. So what's going down for the news? It's kind of a quiet week, yes?
Very quiet as far as UFOs. There's been a few sightings, none of which I think are that spectacular personally, but that we have posted a few. This is news that I really like, and hopefully your listeners will agree as well. And that is, researchers say a meteorite may prove life existed on Mars. Kind of like, well, big deal, you've told us that before, Alejandro Rojas. True, I have. However, previously, when we've talked about this, it's all been from scientists from the Center of Astrobiology at the University of Buckingham. They work with, like, the University of Alabama. We had, you know, a couple years ago, Dr. Hoover, who is a NASA astrobiologist who is part of this group, and they feel they found several meteorites that have microbes in them, and they believe these microbes are either from space or Mars itself. So they feel that they've proven this. However, skeptics are saying, no, those meteorites were contaminated when they hit the ground. What's great about this latest discovery of a meteorite, this one was discovered in the Moroccan desert in 2011, but this is a totally separate group of researchers, and this is a group of researchers from all around the world. One of the bigger schools is out of Sweden, but they've been researching this rock because they feel that they have, again, evidence that there's microbes and organic material in this rock. There's fissures. It's a strange-looking rock, for one. It's kind of glassy and jagged on one end, and there's fissures in it. And in these fissures are deposits of organic material. Again, skeptics have argued, well, we think that that is just contamination from the Earth when it hit. However, scientists have said, no, they've dug in there to find out that those fissures existed on this rock when it was on Mars. There's material there that they believe they've been able to prove was from Mars. And under this material is the organic material that they believe was created due to microbial biological life. And they even say that some of it is like crystallized, like even a diamond, you know. And so that takes a long time to develop. And so they say this is all proof that this group of scientists believes this rock is proof of life on Mars. So they have say they're, of course, being very – this is a big statement. So they're open to ideas to how these elements could have gotten on this rock or in the rock without it being from Mars and showing organic material from Mars, biological organic material. So they're being very careful about this, and they know that there will be people who are skeptical, but they're happy that it starts up, it rekindles debate on the topic. And how interesting. I think, and I would love to hear your opinion on this, I think this is a big deal. I think it is a really big deal when we finally even have the discovery by mainstream science of microbial life, because then no one can deny there's at least life out there, and it opens up the possibilities to everyone. If there's microbes on the next planet to us, what the heck else could be out there?
Absolutely. And did we waste all that money on the rovers? I don't know.
You know, well, that's what these stories talk about, which is really funny. We have all these rovers out there, and we're finding what they're looking for right here on Earth.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think it would be the biggest story of the century. That's what I think, if we mm-hmm. could actually prove it 100%.
It seems like we're on the cusp of it. It seems like we've been on the cusp of it. But I think what's interesting that people don't know also is that there is this raging debate among astrobiologists as to whether or not we have evidence and proof right now of extraterrestrial life. And there are many and a growing number of scientists. This story is a demonstration of that. A growing number of scientists who believe we do have proof of extraterrestrial life.
So let's just say it's that it is accepted. Who accepts it? I mean, just basically mainstream science?
Yeah, that's a great question. Of course, you would have NASA would be a big one. Or other space agencies like the European Space Agency, which is in the next story, or the Chinese Space Agency or what have you. They don't always agree on everything. In fact, the European Space Agency was saying they found proof of water on Mars I think even years before NASA finally admitted that they feel that they acknowledged, you know, the evidence. So they don't always agree. So it's when you say mainstream science, it's not one scientist or one school. It's kind of like a majority. So when you finally have the majority of scientists, take global warming, for instance, 90% of the scientists are in agreement here, if not more. I think it's even 99%. But just because there is a 1 or 2% that do not agree on mankind's influence on global warming, you know, people take that as saying, well, see, mainstream science isn't sure about this because it's not 100%. Well, science isn't about 100% on anything, really. So,
no, all science is open to changes.
So I think once we have bigger groups out there saying yes, that we think, you know, this is the case. Really, we have the scientists from the University of Buckingham, some others. So now you really have a few universities that do this kind of research out there that's backing this sort of idea. But once you have more, you know, and I think it'll kind of be a domino effect once it starts to happen.
Yeah. Well, anything else you have for news is probably going to be disappointing, but I guess we'll move along.
It's not actually, I don't think. I think this is just as exciting. And this is a story that surprisingly, as far as I know, has not hit the English press, but is a big deal in Italy. There is a video of the from November 24th, just a few weeks ago, of Italy's first woman in space. She is on the Soyuz capsule with a Russian commander and then also with a NASA astronaut, and they are docking with the ISS when you hear her like exclaim, "Oh my gosh," and you know she's speaking Italian, so you can't tell the rest of what she's saying, but she's obviously shocked and about something. And then you hear the Russian guy telling her to calm down. And so it's this really cool video of just this shock and awe that you hear in her voice. Well, the video that was posted by the European Space Agency of this docking procedure, you see this little white dot at the beginning of the video kind of cruise across the screen. Then about 3 or 4 minutes later, she makes this exclamation. And in the Italian news stories, they're saying, did she see a UFO? She says that, you know, this what she saw was alien-like or it appeared to be almost alien. So this has been a big story. When I looked into the Italian news, it's all over. Pretty much every Italian newspaper is writing about it. And but I looked more into it because they said they got this almost alien quote from her Google Plus. So I went and looked at her Google Plus, which is in English, and she's got a log there. And on her log of the docking, she talks about how she unstraps her chair and she starts to float. And she looks outside and she sees this amazing blaze of orange light on the solar panels. She calls it vivid, warm, and almost alien, and she couldn't help exclaiming something aloud. And she said, "You probably heard me because the mics were on, and the mission control astronaut told me to calm down," but essentially talking about how excited she was. And then when she got on the station, she told people about it, and they said, "Yeah, you know, every so often when the sun hits the Soyuz, right, the panels light up in this blazing orange that's really amazing." So she just saw it, and she was in awe, which reminds me of this interview I got to do with one of the ISS astronauts where he just said, "You know, we get all this training about doing your job, but when you get out there, you're not prepared for the view. It's just so magnificent. It just blows your mind." And that's one of the things I liked about, like, the movie Gravity. I mean, you get the sense of that with looking at the pictures and everything. So the white little thing that's floating across the screen, to me, looks like it's probably just debris. There's lots of debris around because there's lots of cooling and liquids and stuff. It doesn't look like anything. It's not moving weird. It looks like some tiny little thing speck kind of floating across the screen. She didn't mention that. It looks like her, exclamation of shock had nothing to do with that. It was just the panels turning this bright orange. But I love this story because it is kind of fun because you get this, You know, it's probably how we all would feel. It just, you know, once you first take a look at this amazing view, I think I would probably have a hard time not going, holy crap, you know, or oh my God.
Yeah. Well, I got to tell you, first of all, that was really, really good investigative reporting on your half to go all the way looking through, you know, her Google and all that. And I'm just wondering if people will carry the ball to make it seem like it was a UFO that she was seeing, or they'll look further into it like you did and see what it really was. But you're right. I mean, you can't even imagine. You know, I spoke with Alan Bean, who is the fourth person on the moon. And, you know, you can't even imagine what you're seeing. It just doesn't mm-hmm. – it's surrealistic.
I would imagine it's like sensory overload. It's got to be just amazing. It's just got to be incredible. So, and that's why I love the story. Just that sense of this pure kind of innocent awe for this vision of space that I think the story is a lot of fun. Although, yeah, you're right. You know, there'll be a lot of people running with, oh, Italian astronaut saw UFO and freaked out. You know, yep. I'm sure that's going to be a story some people will
tomorrow.
Run with.
It'll be a story tomorrow. Hey, yeah. So, yeah, I think it's, you know I got to get moving on with the show here, but, you know, it's a shame that space travel in the future coming up, that's actually becoming a reality. But it's just so darn expensive that only the elite can afford to get that experience.
But it'll go down. Everything's really expensive, just like ultra HD TVs right now are crazy expensive. But, you know, the HD TVs we got for $200 on, you know, Black Friday, those used to be $1,000, $2,000, $5,000. So everything goes down. I actually have a Twitter called AstroTrippin'. And I have a site, astrotrippin.com. It just goes to Facebook, where I follow space tourism, and I tweet and I Facebook about space tourism, and essentially just following the mainstream and just like I do with UFOs. And because I find it so interesting, and we're getting to a time where now, yeah, soon, maybe even as soon as next year, if you got the money, you're going to be able to take a mini vacation to space. But it's only a matter of time, you know. It's certainly probably a generation away where, you know, we're going to be able to visit the Bigelow Hotel, orbiting hotel in space.
That'd be awesome. Hey, well, thanks so much. It's been a lot of fun today.
Yeah, it has been, as always. Thank you very much. Of course, people can read the stories on openminds.tv, and you'll link to them as well. Thank you very much.
I will. And so hang in for the music. We're coming right back with John Burroughs and Colonel Charles Hull. I just have not been getting an answer from Charles Hull. Sorry, this is live radio, everyone. We'll give it another shot here.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you perfectly clear. How are you?
Good, good.
Welcome to the show.
Okay, thanks.
And we're just going to keep continuing to try Chuck Holt. And so while I'm doing that, why don't you quickly introduce yourself? I'm sure everybody listening here is very well versed in the Rendlesham Forest. To me, I've said it many times, if anyone ever asked me what the top UFO case is, it's either first or second right there. And I know we don't have to go through the whole thing like we've done. You've probably done it a million times, and everybody's heard it a million times. But you were out there the first night. Can you talk a little bit about that? And meanwhile, just to let you know, I'm going to be trying to dial Chuck Holt, so he may burst right in when he answers. Okay?
Okay. I'll start with the fact that the incident took place over a three-night period in December of 1980. The first night, we came on duty at 11 o'clock, which would have made it Christmas evening, going into Boxing Day. At around 3 o'clock in the morning, strange lights were seen from the East Gate. A three-man patrol, including myself, Sergeant Pedersen, and Airman Komanczak, went out and investigated it. There was an encounter in the forest while we were out there. And the following night, on the second night, when we were off duty, they saw strange lights, and there were some strange occurrences went on with the on-duty flight chief and shift commander. And then, of course, the third night, I was also out there on the third night. That was the incident that Colonel Halt's memo talked quite a bit about, including our night. And he was out in the forest, and there's a radio tape and everything else made of as the incident took place.
Yep. Now, one of the things I've said, you know, a number of times on this show is that there's always been a lot of controversy between everyone involved. And there was such turmoil. And, you know, with especially with the debriefing and, you know, the drugging and you name it, brainwashing, whatever it was. Now, can you go into why the turmoil continues between often between people involved in this?
Well, okay, I want to start with something. The case, you know, happened way back in 1980, and it's interesting in the fact that when it broke in the early 80s, I think 83, 84, and it's grown over the years as far as with social media, the radio, everything's changed. And I think there's been different cases where things have been said that have been misinterpreted by different people, and or, you know, it's kind of like, I think at the end of the day, a lot of different things happen with a lot of different people, and there's people that don't necessarily agree with some of what some people said or how it's come out or what it's done, what it's been going on. And what I feel needs to happen is we all need to sit down together sometime and sit down and just go over it and see where we can come from there. But, I mean, if you want to go into particulars, I think you probably have some questions to ask me about it. It'd be probably easier to answer it that way than just try to summarize the whole thing.
Okay. Just one second. I'm just looking to see what's going on here. I'm getting something from the producer. Okay, hang on. I guess what I would like to ask you, you know, I remember reading somewhere where, weren't you involved also on the third night where you went out to a field? You sort of you ran out toward the object?
Oh, yes. I was out there on the third night. I was off duty, and I went out there. And there's been a lot of things kicked around about that. I mean, I did go out. I did end up meeting up with Colonel Halt's party. I did end up going forward with Adrian Bastenza. And there's been back and forth and all that to the point where now it's been stated that I went out without his permission. But the bottom line is I did end up out there on the third night, and I did end up going forward with Adrian Bastenza, to include the fact that's even on a tape recording that was made several years ago, I think in the early 90s, where he admitted that I did get forward on a tape recording. One of the things that I feel is what took place with Adrian and I moving forward is something that they don't want out. They don't want it openly discussed and everything else is what I feel. That's just my opinion, so.
Mm-hmm. Now, you know, the thing I always, you know, wonder about is, and it always goes back to this, is with about the binary code and all that. There's a lot of controversy about that and the time travel aspect of it. You know, of course, you know, it's anybody's guess to where, you know, some of these things are coming from. But what is your opinion, or do you want to even get into that part of it?
Oh, I have no problems going into any of this. I mean, that's what I'm saying. It's easier to answer questions than it is trying to summarize. Look, the binary code came up late in the game. There's no doubt about it. I've said this on more than one occasion, and I have no way of proving certain things that certain people said happened, to include, you know, the fact that when I got close to it, that's the last thing I remember. And then it was up in the air and gone. So I didn't see Sergeant Pennison go around it and touch it. Or when he said he touched it, got the binary download. That doesn't mean it didn't happen. On the third night, Larry Warren talks about some stuff that he was involved with. I didn't see Larry out there, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen. The binary itself, it came in late in the game. It was in his notebook. I was there when it came out, and that was back in before we came over in 2010. We were doing a shoot for Ancient Aliens, tying into coming over there in December, and then they were going to do a piece on it later on, you know, later on that year. And when we were going through the notebook discussing different things, as we were flipping through it, all of a sudden these ones and zeros came up. They went nuts over it. And what I mean by that is, it wasn't like Jim was saying, hey, I want to show you something. I think you can use this. Ancient Aliens was about ancient stuff. And, you know, coming, you know, from the past and being interfered with some kind of outside force. It could be the aliens, you know, and whatever. And when the codes came up, they went nuts over it. And, excuse me, they asked the...
Hang on just one moment, please. Just one moment. Chuck, we're trying to reach you. We're having trouble getting through. But are you right by the phone? All right. I'm going to hang up. I'm going to try to ring you back. All right. Thanks.
Okay.
I'm sorry about that. I might have to have him call in on our number if there may be something wrong with Skype, actually. Somehow that's corrupt why it won't dial his number. He's sitting right there waiting.
That's some trouble of mine. But anyway, until he calls in, wait a minute, I see him popping up now.
But it's it hasn't been ringing. If it goes away,
okay. All right, okay. Anyway, the bottom line with the binary code, all right, is this. They ran it. They came up with this stuff. It's been looked at even closer with more stuff coming up, you know, as far as possible coordinates, a message, and everything else. Okay, go ahead and see.
Sounds good. Oh, it's gone.
Okay. So I've said this, okay? I've got no way to prove anything on the binary code other than they took it, a message, something came out of it. It's been deciphered by different people. There's supposedly some connections to a message within it. I think that it deserves to be looked at closely. You know, I think some more research needs to be done on it. And, I it's going to sound kind of crazy, but time will tell, you know, where it leads and what happens with it. And I think that it's foolish to just discard it openly just because of the fact that you have doubts about it. I mean, there's so many things that have happened in the history of mankind that at first were laughed at and later to be proven true.
Right. Well, what I'm going to do right now is I'm going to ask you a question, then I'm going to have to actually step away from the mic and call Colonel Halt and have him dial our Skype number. So the question I want to ask is... Can you explain, right now there is, I know we're really going to be jumping around, we're going way far ahead here, but can you explain what is going on currently with your medical issues in regards to fighting for what is rightly yours, as far as I'm concerned, as far as the effects of this whole event?
Yeah, I sure can, and that's one of the more interesting things to this. Shortly after the incident, you know, right within a matter of days, I didn't feel well, and I had some health issues leading up into the summer of 81, where they found when I was in an emergency room, believe it or not, that I had a heart murmur. And there's a couple of interesting things about that. Number one, you can't come in the military with a heart murmur. It's one of the disqualifiers. Okay, and number two, when I came in, my entry physical showed I didn't have a heart murmur. So they found a heart murmur. Some stuff went on then with it, trying to figure out what it was. But, you know, years went by, and then a few years ago, I started getting really sick. And my civilian doctor could not really figure out why my heart was doing what it was doing. And we had a discussion when I, right after I had one of my surgeries, and it came down to when did it first happen? And I told him, and he says, well, who holds those records? And I said, well, they're in my military records. And he says, well, I want them. So he wrote a letter, and we tried to get them. And we didn't get a response. They wouldn't even acknowledge us. So I went ahead and went through my senator, Senator Kyle, who was, he's now retired, but he was my current senator at the time in Arizona. And he was also big pro, you know, veterans, and he did a lot of work within the VA. So I sent him a packet, you know, outlining what happened and what went on and what I was trying to get. Well, they went ahead and they requested my personnel records and my medical records. And, neither one of them were where they were supposed to be for me being retired. So they wrote me back saying that they weren't where they were supposed to be, and they were going to continue to try to find out where they were. A little time later, the senior aide that had been working on VA issues for years contacts me back and says, well, I hate to say this, but basically there's a good chance your records are classified. We don't know why, but they're classified. Hmm. And what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to go in and file a disability claim. And when you do that, we've got more weight to go ahead and push to get your, you know, to get your records. So I said, all right. So I went in, filed all the paperwork, came back, turned it right over to them. They were right down the street from where I filed it at the VA. And they said, well, they'll take it from there. I didn't hear anything for months. And then I sent a letter to them again, and I had a letter back, and it was a really interesting letter. It says, well, we couldn't get them, sorry, but we recommend that you continue working, trying to get them, and that you go through Senator John McCain's office, or you could go through the replacement for Senator Cobb, but we recommend Senator McCain. So, oh, and in between, that was one other interesting thing. When I met with her to hand her my stuff that day, she came out and she looked at me. She says, you know, she goes, we'll probably never be able to tell you what happened to you or why it happened to you, but we're going to do our best to get you treated. So there was something going on even with her inquiries that she knew it fell into something within the classified realm. She just didn't, either she knew or couldn't say or had an idea or whatever, but it went that way. So I went in Senator McCain's office, gave him all the paperwork, and they started doing more inquiries. Meanwhile, I was it was waiting forever for me to get CNMA claim and any follow-up with them VA at all, which is stuff that's been going on. So that could be coincidental. Well, Senator McCain's office, as soon as I got a hold of him, got me in to be seen right away, and it moved up my disability a little bit. Well, when I went in and saw the doctor, she had this big stack, like, of records that looked like in an envelope, and she kept referring to them. But as we went along, she was asking questions, and she started asking me questions about my heart and everything. And then she said, all of a sudden, she's looked at me and says, look, she says, we have no record of you being in the Air Force from 79, I think it was 82, or we have no any medical records for you during that time frame. And I looked at her, and I said, that's interesting. And I had a file with me. I pulled it out. I said, well, what about this? And then she saw my physical. She saw my pay records. She saw this. She goes, her eyes got real big. She goes, well, she goes, I don't know what to say. She goes, I said, so how are you going to give me a fair evaluation if you don't have all the data? She says, well, that's for a pay grade above my level to decide. She goes, I'll write what up I have, and that's it. So this would have been like April or March. July, I get this notification that they deny me a disability based on the fact I wasn't in the Air Force from 79 to 82, and there was no medical records. And not only that, the DD Form 214 that they produced showing my service time was altered. It showed that I didn't come in the Air Force until 1982. So they actually altered my DD Form 214.
Is this unprecedented? It's got to be.
I honestly don't know. We did get a phone call because it went to Senator Sanders' office, too, because he was the head of the VA, to put some more pressure on. And one of his aides came back, or somebody called in and said, well, to the lawyer, he says, well, you know, when you classified things go on, sometimes DD Form 214s are changed. They did say that. And the records, I'd say, a lot of times they don't get held back. They just come back redacted. In my case, they haven't even come back, and my records were altered. And then when McCain's office, after about 6 weeks, and I even got involved with the Air Force, and they actually, I talked to them on the phone, AFRPC, and they said, you weren't in. And I says, wait a minute, there's records in there showing I was. I said, sorry, you weren't in. And what I did was I went around to retirement, and I asked how I could be retired if I wasn't. And we got a bunch more records to the Air Force. And all they did, there was no apology, there was nothing, no explanation, no anything, other than, okay, we've changed your DD Form 214. And as far as the VA goes, they're breaking the law again. Besides the fact my records are mine, they should be released to me. Also, they will not answer some FOIA questions that have been given to them. They're now a year old. They continue to say they're looking into them. So they won't answer FOIA. They won't release my medical records. Even some of my current stuff is now classified on my art, if you can believe that or not. It's classified. Certain VA doctors can't get at it. And that's a fact. I mean, they go into my files and it's locked down. And they told me that. They says, we don't have access to this data. That only certain people do.
Unbelievable.
So it continues. I did get a different VA lawyer because the lawyer is helping me for kind of a little bit different matter. And he can't do direct VA stuff. He can help, but he can't. So I got a VA lawyer. When he got involved and he didn't like it, and he actually went to the head of the VA, the head legal counsel for the VA, and started making inquiries. And all of a sudden they came back and they offered me a deal. They says, well, come back. We obviously have some new information. We'll do an FDC, which takes 90 days or less, and we'll take care of it. Well, that was in May. In July, they sent me a letter saying that they didn't acknowledge my FDC claim. And when inquiries were made by McCain's office, they said it got knocked out of the system. They eliminated, somebody above them eliminated my FDC request. So not only that, that's been altered and tampered with. And now I filed an IG complaint, and this is all being investigated by the inspector general. I'm not holding my breath. And they're looking into it further. But my DD Form 214 was altered. They won't release my medical records. They won't answer my FOIA. And they've also, they took out somebody that they won't acknowledge who took out my fully developed claim. And then another interesting thing was, when we did that Stephen Bassett conference a couple of years ago, all the people, the ex-members of Congress, wrote a letter to the president and to the head of the VA at the time, who's now resigned. And both of those letters didn't get acknowledged, but they ended up in my case file. So somebody up there at the presidential level got the letter, and so did the head of the VA, and they shot it back down to the evaluators.
So they're paying attention to you. Hey, we have a message board, by the way. If you're listening live, you can jump over to podcastufo.com and quickly jump into the message board, ask some questions. One up there right now, I think I know the answer to part of this anyway. Is this happening to any other men? Or just you? Are you the only one? Did you witness more than the others? Is that the reason why? And what was your rank? You were actually an officer, right?
No, I was an E3. I was an Airman First Class. It was my first assignment.
So I'm sorry, but you were like a not police, but
No, I was security. We were called security police at the time. I was considered law enforcement specialist. Yes.
Yeah. Uh huh. So, is that true that it is isn't it happening to Peniston?
Well, that's an interesting thing that you always say about the different things that happened. We went to D.C. He was there. The whole thing went in front of these people. A big deal was made about it. And then shortly after that, and he's done a couple radio interviews, says, well, I had this piece of paperwork that I was holding back. I gave to the VA, and they're taking care of me now. And he won't comment on it any further. So I'm not really sure. I know other people had medical issues, including Larry Warren, but I was the only one that had pushed it as far as this part, you know, has taken it this far. Now, across the board, it's interesting. If I've met different people that have been in the military and different agencies, working in different agency stuff, that have been involved in classified operations. You know, and when I say classified operation, I wasn't out there on a classified information. What happened to me appears to have been made classified. Well, there's other people that have been wearing around weaponry and done different things that their records also have been locked down and they can't get the proper data and stuff. So it goes on not just with me. There's other people that have had issues with it. What makes my issue interesting is the fact is that a lot of people claim nothing really happened to us. Well, why would my medical records be locked down?
Exactly.
Why would all this stuff? Well, we did. Oh, and there's more to it. I've done some FOIA with the British MOD and the American government. The American government, the State Department admitted something happened. It was an international incident, but they won't release the records. And other than unless the Air Force allows it, the Air Force denies there's any records exist. The CIA will need to confirm or deny if they're holding classified information on our incidents. The MOD, I got them to admit they were holding 18 policy files, which includes some Rendlesham stuff in it, through FOIA, and yet they keep stalling when they're going to release it. And that all ties into Project Condyne, which has now been declassified. And in Project Condyne, it admits that there were people involved in a Renstrom case that were exposed to radiation while they were out there, you know, in contact with the phenomenon itself.
Now, do you feel as though that you were exposed to radiation?
Oh, there's no doubt, because one of the interesting things that happened, and it's been made a big deal about, and I really can't tell you what the underlying thing is to why this person came forward. But after the conference we did with Steve Bassett, an individual that had been involved in CIA for years and retired and as a consultant approached our lawyer, and he was requesting certain information on us. But along the way, he helped open up some of the stuff to get me treated through some radiation that he was aware of that I was exposed to.
Wow. Now let's dial it back a little bit, and we're still trying to reach Colonel Halt. I gave him a number to call. I'm just not sure if there's some type of phone issue, so I might have to step away again because I'm really going to try to get this going here. Someone else wants to know what your view on the portrayals of Rendlesham Forest stories on Sci-Fi or History. Two, are they accurate or not?
Well, okay, look, there's a couple of things about documentary people have to understand. Number one, there's an investor that drops the money to do this. Okay. Number two, there's a production company that does it for the investor. Okay. And number three, they'll do an interview. Some of the earlier interviews weren't as good as the later ones because they didn't have the data or they didn't do the research or whatever. There's been some good research done on this and more data put out there. But ultimately, it comes down to the investor, you know, which involves whichever network, too, like Sci-Fi, the History, or whatever. And they have the final say on what comes out. So do they take things and make it more sensational? Sometimes, yes. Do they cut out some of the better stuff in our minds? Yes, sometimes. But ultimately, what they're doing it for and what people don't understand is this is still entertainment. I mean, they're out there trying to sell product to the public to get good ratings. So there's things that we don't always agree with, but there's a lot of also good stuff that's done, and it makes more, puts out more awareness to the cases themselves, you know, the case that other people's cases themselves. So, yeah, there's good and bad to it. You know, that's what happens when somebody else has the final say.
Well, you know, it's I spoke with Chuck earlier, and I asked him what he thought was the best portrayal of what happened in his thought was that it was the unsolved mysteries in 1991. Do you feel basically the same? That's the most accurate?
Well, the unsolved mysteries had a lot of witnesses in it. Yeah, they did. I mean, they had quite a few witnesses come that were in it. That was shortly after. I would say unsolved mysteries did a decent job. I would also say the CNN piece that Chuck DeCarlo did. I wasn't in that one. That was another decent one that was done early on. And there's been a couple other ones. You know, that there was a one done on a history piece, and I can't remember. It was put out on the History Channel, but it would have been done, I think, on the 20th anniversary. And that had just about everybody in it except for a few people, and I thought that one was well done, too.
Really? Yep. I think I've watched that one. You know, this is, I would say that of any case that it's ever been so obvious that it's been a cover-up, you'd have to agree it would be this one, wouldn't you?
Well, Roswell, I don't know a lot about it, but there was something to Roswell, and there's something to other cases. What makes this case interesting is you've got the fact that it was military personnel involved, okay? And people say, well, we're more credible. Well, okay, yeah, we've got more training, but, you know, it's still, we weren't trained in how to deal with UFOs, okay? number two, there is a memo. There is a memo, the cult memo, that admits it happened, okay? Number three, Condyne is come in to, later. They did a study, and Condyne itself is very, very eye-opening, and Rendlesham's involved in it. So, and then you've got, you know, you've got so many different witnesses that were involved that, you know, overall, there's no doubt something happened. There's no doubt it was something, you know, that's, you know, unbelievable, you know, and it's to me, it's just, I don't know. You know, people have to be the judge on it, but I think it's one of the most important ones. Yes, I do.
You know what? This is really strange. I just had the Skype number come up on my phone as dialing through, but it won't show up on the Skype on the computer, which is.
Have you tried his home phone number?
Yeah, I'm using his home number, but I mean it's just.
Have you just tried? Can you call him on his phone and tie a phone number in without doing it through Skype, or does it have to be done through Skype?
I'm trying everything.
Okay, that is strange.
Yeah,
this has happened before.
It's never happened before.
No, but on other shows and stuff, there's been all kinds of weird things that have happened at certain points.
Well, you know it's the government, right?
probably the odds are if I had to lay a dollar bet down, yeah, I'd have to agree with you. But, you know, what good does it do? But,
yeah.
I mean, the thing about the case is that you got a lot of documentation that happened. There now is declassified documents admitted that it happened besides a Colonel Halt memo. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
There's so much out there showing that something strange happened over a 3-night period in the fields. But what we don't have the answer for, and I know it may make a lot of people mad, we don't know for sure what it was. We can say, well, what we saw did this and that, and we've never seen anything like it. And we can say it was probably from somewhere else. Time travel's come up because under Jim and mine hypnosis, it does come out. You know, the codes lead to that possibility, I guess. But ultimately, there are a couple things you can't answer. Not just in our case, but really, what are we dealing with? Where is it from? Why is it here? What's it doing? I mean, what's its ultimate goal?
That is the $6 billion question or whatever you want to call it. Because, you know, it's one that... I don't know if we'll ever know, but we certainly don't know now, that's for sure.
Well, and that's what I mean, and that's why I think Condyne's so important. It goes into details about how it affects us, you know, why we are the way we are is when we're affected, you know, how it affects us and what it does to us and how we react to it and everything else. And another interesting thing, Edgar Mitchell did an interview about 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5 now. It was done through an English station. But he was talking about Condyne in that interview at a certain point, as far as, you know, that the phenomenon is there, it's real, and there's been studies done on it, there's been committees that are working on it or have worked on it. So they're looking at it. My personal opinion is I can't explain to you why we don't know more about it or what it is, unless it doesn't want to let us. But I do know our governments, I feel, are keeping it secret because it can be used as a weapon.
Most likely. Now, I'm going to do an experiment, and mm-hmm. I'm hoping everyone can bear with me. What I'm going to do is I'm going to put him on speakerphone, and we'll just see what happens and see if this can even work. So I'm going to give him a try right now. And again, I really apologize to the listener. Can you hear that?
Hello, I hear you. I've pulled you back
a couple of
times to get your recorded message.
Is that right? Well, I don't understand what's going on. It's some type of corrupt thing going on with Skype tonight, and I have no idea. Sorry about that, Charles. First of all, can you hear Charles, John?
Yeah, I can hear.
You can hear?
Yeah.
And so, Charles, why don't we try to do this? And now, this is really awkward. I've never done anything like this before, but I actually have you on speakerphone. So, welcome to the show. I'm sorry for the trouble we're having tonight.
Oh, thank you.
Yep. My arm is going to get really tired holding my phone in front of the microphone for an hour and 10 minutes. But, Charles. Would you rather me call you Chuck or Charles?
Chuck, most people do.
Okay, very good. So, again, I really want to apologize, but we were talking a number of different things. We didn't go into the story real deeply, but went into John's medical issues that he's had and what he's trying to accomplish through that. We talked a little bit about the binary code. And what is your, if you don't mind throwing out your opinion on the binary code, if you have one?
It's hard to say. I have issues with it, I guess. I won't say it isn't right. I have problems accepting it.
Mm-hmm. And you know, Jim is not here to defend himself, and I understand that, you know, but, you know, you hear stories about, oh, someone saw the notebook ahead of time, you know, without the code in it, and I don't know if that's true or not. But also, what is your, you know, we were talking earlier, we don't really know what any of these sightings are or that any of us have seen. You know, it would come to mind right off the bat to me if I saw what you saw, according just listening to your audio tape alone, I could only imagine it'd be from another planet, another life.
Somewhere else, or another dimension, potentially.
Yeah, that's all things we can't, you know, we can't discount. As far as the tape goes, it's all over the internet, isn't it?
There's a long story behind it. Yes, it is.
Well, how did that happen?
After the incident, Ted Conrad, who was my boss at the time, asked me to make him a copy of the tape. So we each had a little micro recorder. We carried them in our pocket because it was easier than taking notes, and you know, it was convenient. And we had it like a dictaphone, and we just give the tape to the secretary, and she would type things up. In other words, when I went around the base and saw something needed done or made a note of something, I'd bring it back, and the secretary would type it up. That's why I had my tape recorder with me. I carried it almost all the time. Anyhow, Conrad asked me to make a copy for him, so I laid the two tape recorders side by side because there was no capability to electronically transfer in those days, and I made him a copy. He put it in the desk drawer. I forgot about it. I don't know whether he forgot about it or not, but anyhow, he moved on, and Sam Morgan came. Now, Sam Morgan and I had some issues. He had some real problems with his children, and the police got involved, and I told the police to do what they normally would do. They said, but it's a colonel's son. I said, well, and he never forgave me. But anyhow, he found the tape. He became my boss. He found the tape in the drawer. He said, what's this? And I told him. He played it and listened to it. Says, oh, and I never thought any more about it. Unbeknownst to me, he started playing it at cocktail parties in different places for people. He thought it was amusing. Somehow or other, it got back to the equivalent of MUFON people in England. I don't remember what they called themselves. And a gentleman by the name of Harry Harris, a solicitor, a lawyer from Manchester, somehow or other, got involved and asked him for a copy of the tape. Well, Sam Morgan gave it to him. Harry Harris sold it to a guy by the name of Yehu or something like that, a Japanese fellow, for a small fortune. Hmm. And suddenly it was everywhere.
Oh, jeez. How about that?
Well, ask John. John was selling copies of my tape and selling copies of my memo. I have one of his advertisements from back in 1980, whatever. I don't remember now. Everybody and his brother had it. Now, the memo got out a little differently. The memo got out because it was one copy. It was done on a sewing typewriter with a carbon manifold. You know what that is, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
We had no copy in the office other than that thing, and it dishonored where it went. It was given to Don Moreland, the squadron leader Moreland, to send to the MOD, which he did, according to him, and I'm sure he did. He also, unbeknownst to me, sent a copy to his liaison officer or his superior, 3rd Air Force. He apparently made copies. I don't know what happened over there, but anyhow, threw it around over there. Somebody found out about the memo, and a writer by the name of Larry Fawcett and Barry Greenwood came in under the Freedom of Information Act of Bentwaters and asked for a copy of the memo. And at that time, Jack Conner was my boss. And he showed it to me, and then I had to explain the whole story to him. And he went back and said, we don't have a copy, which we didn't. So a little time passed, and somebody at 3rd Air Force talked to somebody, and I don't know exactly how the word got out, but the word got out that there was a copy there. So again, Larry Fawcett came in, 3rd Air Force, and asked for a copy of it. Well, at that time, the 3rd Air Force commander was Pete Bent, and Pete was a good friend of mine. I had gone to a base commander school with him many years earlier, and he called me up and says, I have this memo. It's interesting. He said, we have a Freedom of Information request, and we're going to have to release it. I said, oh, please don't. Burn it. I said, you release that, your life and mine will never be the same. That's an understatement.
That was an understatement, yes.
He released a copy to Larry Fawcett, and it got into MUFON and Lord knows where all else, and suddenly I'm at ITV, Japanese TV, BBC One, BBC Two, Radio Orwell, the local paper, everybody and their brother. I had to go into hiding almost. So yeah. That's how the story got out.
Now,
what prompted Larry Fawcett to come searching for it is Larry Warren went back to the States and carried a tale, and that's another story. Somehow got hooked up with Barry Greenwood and Larry Fawcett, and they were going to write a book until they figured out. How shall I say? They didn't want to touch him with a pole after they figured out what was going on. But anyhow, he made enough noise that Fawcett knew that there was a document somewhere.
Now, when you wrote the document and you actually sent it, was there any backlash right away? You know, I mean, no one's ever received a document like that.
None whatsoever.
Really?
I had total support from my superiors because most of them were on the radio listening to my conversation when I'm calling the command post, say, look here for this, look here for that, how about this? And they keep telling me, you know, nobody sees anything, which we find out later is untrue.
Now, there's been, I don't know if I want to say controversy, there's been varied reports about seeing beams of light down toward the weapons themselves. What is the more or less the final word on that?
One thing I can say with certainty is when the object from the south came overhead, it sent a beam down equivalent to a laser beam in our feet. That I can say with great certainty. The other object of the south moved over the base at Bentwaters. We could see that and see beams coming down in or near the weapon storage area. That was a mile, mile and a half away. I could hear the chatter. Keep in mind, there were two cops with me, three actually, the lieutenant, and each one of them had a radio. One was on the law enforcement frequency and one was on a security frequency, which the people in the weapon storage area would be using. And I could hear the chatter. They were talking about seeing things in beams. That's all I can say.
Right. Okay. Right. And John, do you know anything about that part?
No. Other than did something go into the weapon storage area? Again, the radio acted up, but some of the people that were inside there claimed that nothing actually, you know, happened inside the area, just outside of it. That's the best I could tell you.
Now, when you two were at the same location on the last night of the event, and Charles, you more or less saw John and you knew that he was approaching the light out in the blue light out in the field.
No, I did not see John. John was back at the Forest Service Road where the vehicles and the light alls were parked. That's where he was supposed to be, and that's where all the cops that didn't come forward, the four that came forward with me, the rest were told to stay there and to stay quiet. And John borrowed a radio, apparently, from one of them, a police radio, and called to me and asked if he could come forward, and I told him no.
Okay.
So whatever happened to him back there, I don't know, because I was 150 yards away and then way further after that.
Okay. One of the things, Chuck, I think I talked to you in North Carolina about was you saw this thing, this single object, burst into several lights. And
very brilliant, bright white lights.
And
so the thing I can equate it to is sort of like a small fireworks display.
And, you know, I believe I told you this in North Carolina. I have a friend, he's actually on a TV show, so he'd never come forward on this, but he experienced a very similar thing back about 1978, where a square object that was hovering that shot up over a mountain burst into five lights and made a formation. I mean, that's the only two.
There were five, they broke into five lights. I'm almost positive it was five. We're very close there, too.
It's amazing. And he said the lights actually started blinking like they were almost like communicating or something. But, I mean, that's the only two times I've ever heard this situation. And when my friend told me this story, I couldn't believe it. This was at Amherst College down in Massachusetts. And there was a whole bunch of witnesses as well.
I kept thinking maybe this was ball lightning. I'd never seen ball lightning, but I certainly heard about it. You know, and when it exploded, I said, gosh, how do you explain this?
Right, right. Well, you know, we're at the top of the hour, and This is a situation where if I could reach the producer right now and see if I could actually reboot and try to catch you on Skype, but I don't even dare to. I think I'm going to have to hang on to the speakerphone. So right now we're at the top of the hour, and we're going to be having some questions coming up on the chat room. It's kind of hard for me to tend to that this evening. But so right now it's 9 o'clock, and we're taking just a break here. So if you're listening live, hang in. And, you know, I'm not even going to play any music. We're just going to move on to the second hour. As far as the aftermath of this whole thing, I've already been speaking with John earlier about it, but for you...
Can I bring up something real fast?
Oh, absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay. All right. Colonel, how are you doing tonight?
Can you hear him?
No, I can't. I'd like to hear what he has to say, because maybe I can add something.
There is a way to do this. If you're near a computer, Charles, I'm just so sorry to... Let me just see if there's anything I can do. Why don't you ask the question, John, and I'll relay it. And I really apologize to the listener for this.
Okay. My question is simple. Okay, on the third night, all right, it's kind of a twofold question. Number one, he claims I never came forward, yet I've got him doing an interview where he did say I got out in front of him, got out in front of his group with Adrian Bastenza. And number two, what does he feel we encountered, and does he feel he had any kind of missing time or anything like that?
Okay, so Charles, it's a little bit difficult, and I'm wondering, Charles, Chuck, do you have any way to get in front of a computer right now?
I think so. Why would you want me to do?
Well, you could just go to darkmatterradio.net and listen to the show live, actually, and then you could definitely hear everything that that John is saying. Dark Matter Radio.
Dark Matter, all one word?
Yep. darkmatterradio.net. Now, there is a 20-second delay in streaming, but at least you'll be able to hear, you know, basically what's going on. You can't have it too loud or you get feedback.
Dark Matter Radio Net, Paranormal Central.
That's it.
Which one do I want to go to? You got about four or five places.
Yeah, it's darkmatterradio.net is the URL.
Okay, we'll try going there and see what I get.
And
play. Is that what I want?
It should, yeah, it should play, automatically play. So what John just asked, John, I don't want to mess up what you just asked me, so that's why I'm hoping that he can hear it. So,
okay.
John, can you go ahead and ask that question again?
Sure, and I understand there's a 20-second delay. Well, the interesting thing on the third night, and this is where I want to the question I'm going into, is I have an interview that you did, Colonel, and in the interview you told the two people involved that I was the only one that got out in front of you that night. Adrian Bastenza and I did go forward in front of you at one point. The point is that I understand, and I've always said this, I never was with your group when you were out there doing the tape and all that stuff. But towards the end, when you were coming back, I did go forward in front of you. And you did say that in a radio, or actually an interview. It's recorded. I just want to know what you have to say about that. I talked to you about that once before.
I don't remember saying that, and I do know that I did order everybody back to the base. Now, I won't say John didn't go somewhere off on his own.
Okay. So, Chuck, you're going to just have to keep that away from your phone just so there's no feedback, if you would, please. Okay, we're going to reboot, so hang in there if you would. We'll be right back. I can't believe it. We're back. if you're listening live, again, I really want to give a big apology for this, but we figured it out. We have everyone's on Skype, but we can all hear each other now. Welcome back, Chuck and John.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Okay, so now, if you would, can you reiterate the question in that was the last question you did?
Yeah, sure. All right, Colonel. Colonels lead, don't they, sir?
Pardon?
Colonels lead, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How about this? It's been suggested, and I think you're aware of the suggestion. Don't you think it's time we all get together someplace, sit down, and see what we can come up with?
I'm agreeable to that, as long as it's the players.
Okay.
In other words, I don't want to fight with Peter Robbins anymore. I'm tired of hearing him.
Well, right. That would be if they did. That would be something to do separate with those people. I'm talking about the people that were involved in the incident themselves.
I'm willing to talk about it.
Okay, that's where I think at the end of the day we might be able to make some final sense out of it. That's just my take, and that was my question.
I think it's
in other words, we're talking Bruce England, if you can get him, Adrian Bastanza, Bobby Ball, Jim, and Cabana Sack, if you can find him.
Right.
And are these one of the questions I've always wondered? Is there because of this common link, has there over the years been some sort of reaching out to each other, like? Out of the public's eye?
Not as a total group, no.
Mm-hmm. Now,
some of the players will not get involved, like in TNL, for instance, Bruce England, and I was surprised to see that Adrian Bastanza is maybe willing to talk again. And I have no idea where Cabana Sack is.
Mm-hmm. As far as, you know, this is something that, you know, 1980 is... You know, we talk about the two big incidents. This is what I consider the, you know, in the two large, you know, most credible incidents out there as far as I'm concerned, and a number of people I know feel the same way. Everybody's alive pretty much right now. You know, when it comes to Roswell, there's only a couple left. So it would be really a good thing if this could, you know, if you could get together, smooth out your differences, and I don't know if that'll ever really happen. I mean, not only, I'm going to say differences, but there's a lot of controversy between, you know, what different people are saying that may have somewhat to do with the brainwashing as well. Is that right?
Well, I think Jim and John and I are pretty much saying, to a certain extent, the same thing.
Mm-hmm. And then the others out there, you're saying that are...
Well, the only other one out there is Larry Warren, and I have mm-hmm. some pretty strong evidence now.
Okay.
That I'm not going to put out on the air.
All right.
But it doesn't affect them.
Mm-hmm. Now, Larry was not... he was only there for something like 4 weeks ahead of time?
Something like that. I don't have the exact dates in front of me.
Yeah. And would someone that was there for 4 weeks normally have the ability to go off base?
If they were taken or ordered off base, yes.
Okay. All right.
The initial question I had for him is how he got his air base ground defense training and all the necessary training and from the time he arrived to been posted on flight. It certainly is possible.
Mm-hmm. John, you were about to say something?
Well, there was a couple of things I was going to bring up. What I said earlier, Colonel, and I'm going to re-say it again. The binary code came up, Larry Warren, everything else came up. And what I have said, and I've said over the whole years, is I remember certain things, but I didn't see Jim walk around it. I didn't see him touch it. I didn't see him, you know, all that stuff happen. I didn't see Larry Warren out there in the field. But none of that means that didn't happen. And when you have different people, even Adrian has some things that he said early on and then he's went quiet for a while that don't add up. But at the end of the day, if you got everybody in a room, maybe you could understand why the different things have been said. And then one other thing that has come up, I just returned from the UK in September. I understand there, as far as the base goes, I was never aware of an underground facility other than over at Wing Intel, and that was more like a basement. But there is an underground facility sitting right outside of the base, 4 miles away. They have tunnels that lead right up into the area of the base itself. It's there. I was there when it's been discovered. What do you say about all that?
Well, let me tell you something. I have a very good personal friend that owned the area that was taken over by the base for World War II, the Kimballs, Bill and Jeannie Kimball, and I know their son John and Sarah, who now run Bentwaters Park. They were little kids running around underfoot whenever I was there, but I spent a lot of time with them. They were upon the Anglo-American Committee. Bill now has the Bentwaters industrial side. He bought it all back from the UK government. And he can tell you, and he will tell you, that there is no underground facility there. There are a couple of sub-basements. In fact, I think there's a sub-basement or partial basement under the OSI building, but I'm not positive.
Right, right. But what if some of these people that felt they were on Bentwaters actually were just taken down the road 3 miles?
Well, I don't know.
Right. That's all I'm saying. At the end of the day...
But the comment is, an elevator came up inside the photo lab. Well, but the building identified as a photo lab is a command post. The command post sits on 2 or 3 feet of reinforced concrete. I spent so much time in that place that I could know every inch of it, and it's open now as a museum, and you can go in there and look.
Right, and that's the old... You're talking about the old command post now, not the new one they built, right?
No, I'm talking about the reinforced structure.
No, I know, but they built a new one after we left, is what I'm saying. But the old command post that was tore down is what you're talking about, right?
No, it wasn't tore down. It's a museum.
What? I thought that was rebuilt. That's what I was told.
John. Sarah and John Kimball have turned it into a museum.
Well, I know it's a museum, but I thought that was the new command post. I thought they rebuilt it. They built a new command post.
No. Okay. I helped them. I went in and spent some time there and said this was here and that was there and so forth.
Okay. But I guess where I'm going with this, if they were taken 3 or 4 miles off base and they were made to believe they were still on the base, is that not possible? Because you do believe a bunch of us were tortured, correct?
I won't say tortured. I would say we were worked over psychologically.
Okay.
And with...
Okay, I'm sorry. Keep going. I didn't mean to interrupt. I have a follow-up question.
Because one time you told me you remembered, then you said you weren't. But I know 3 different people told me they ran into you going into the OSI building the next day or the day after.
Okay, fair enough. But here's my $10 question. Why did they do that to us? What are they covering up? Because what comes out, supposedly, if we were, a lot of us were messed with, is exactly what that we dealt with something from somewhere else. So why would they mess with us to tell us that we were dealing with something or somewhere else, which you've openly said in a statement where we were dealing with ET? So why would they do that? What was the reasoning behind that is what I'm asking
Disinformation, and that's what I think Larry Warren has been used as a patsy.
But disinformation in what way, though, is what I'm asking.
A story so ridiculous that nobody believes it, except Peter Robbins, maybe.
Okay, but...
In fact, I know he knows the truth, too.
Okay, so what exactly do you think we were dealing with, sir?
I don't know. I wish I knew.
But when you said it was ET, what made you feel it was from ET at one point?
It was something beyond anything we know.
Okay.
I drew a conclusion.
Okay, all right.
I drew a conclusion.
Okay, so are you aware of Project Condyne?
Yes.
Okay, what do you think of that report?
Well, I really don't think it applies here.
Even though it mentioned us in the report?
I don't remember seeing your name in the report.
Not our name, but there were people involved in our incident that were exposed to radiation. It was in the report itself.
Well, you could have been. But what we picked up 3 nights later was, significant but not enough to be harmful. However, I don't know what it was or what the half-life is. You could have been exposed to something very, very serious.
Okay. I mean, do you have any idea?
That's why I wrote the letter for you, if you remember, to try and help you. And I made some phone calls you don't know about.
I wouldn't know about phone calls, but I do know the letter was sent in. What do you think about my records being classified?
That puzzles me. It really does. And why did they screw around so much with Larry Warren? That's a good question. And when we did the organizational inspection of NSA, before I sent my team chief out, Colonel Bill Shy, who went out and did the inspection. Actually, I went out on the in-brief and met the director and everybody else. And I sent him out the following day with a team. And I told him, you tell your counterpart, because at that time Larry Warren was calling me and telling me, I'm going public, that Washington Post is going to print this on the front page, and on and on and on and on. So I told Bill Shay, who was doing the inspection, I said, you tell your counterpart, if they have any involvement in this, now's the time to, to come clean, to bury it, or whatever they need to do. They're going to get embarrassed if they aren't careful. And he no sooner got out there than I got a call from the chief of the compromise branch. He said, what's this all about? He said, I don't know anything about it. But the more we talked, the more I realized he knew a whole lot more than I did about Larry Warren and you guys. Interesting, isn't it?
Well, no, it is. And not only that, but the fact that the records are classified, my personnel, my DD Form 214 was altered. It said I wasn't in the Air Force from 79 to 82.
Well, we know you were.
Well, I know that, but that really was altered. And the other fact I'm not sure if you're aware of, but I have a FOIA where the State Department admitted they're holding material on the incident.
Well, that doesn't surprise me, but I don't know why the State Department wouldn't let somebody refer it over there.
Well, it would be an international incident, wouldn't it? Isn't that why they got involved in overseas stuff?
Well, it may tie into the weapon storage area. I can't answer all those questions. I don't know. I have as many questions as you do.
Right, and that's what I'm saying. I just think it would really help if we could all get together and bury the hatchet and try to come
out. I'm very willing to do. I don't want to deal with Larry Warren anymore, though. I know enough about what he did and what's wrong with the book and everything else, and I have some sworn statements in writing that are very interesting.
Well, I understand that, but, I mean, do you believe everything he said is false? Is that what you're trying to say?
No. He picked up stories from other people.
Do you believe that he was messed with, though?
Definitely.
Then why would they mess? Well, I understand it. Then why would they mess with him if he didn't have some kind of involvement?
Because they found somebody that was they could fly and how should I say, put out a good story.
Okay. But
I got a question for you. Do you remember Adrian Bastenza being with me?
Yeah. I know he was out there because I met up with you guys and I went forward.
Yeah, he came out with us in the Jeep and he stayed with me the whole time.
Right.
And Larry claims that he was with him. That's just for starters.
No, I understand that. That is one of the questions I've had. How could Adrian be three places at one time?
What does Adrian say about this?
Adrian's only comment recently was simply that he saw Larry out there. I definitely was out there with him at one point, and the incident took place. And he hasn't gone any further than that.
Yeah, he was Security 10. He's on my tape.
No, I know. He's on the tape. I know. He was out there. And that was one of the questions people brought up. How could, Adrian be in three places at one time? Because at one point on the tape, he's actually out there bringing light alls out, too. So, but I just think that
to answer your question, John, yes, I would be happy to sit down with you and Adrian, Jim, and Bruce England if we could get him available, and Cabanasac if he could be found.
I know where Ed's at. He's scared to death.
Well, I'm sure.
He's scared to death. But I think that if it's handled right, I think it could be done. I know where Lieutenant England's at, too.
Well, the funny thing is, Bruce and I joked about this for several years. After he left Bentwaters, he went to Ramstein. Mm-hmm. I was over there one day at TDY, and I ran into him in the BX, and we laughed about it. So a couple years later, when the Unsolved Mysteries program came along, I contacted him, and he went ballistic, threatened to sue me and all kinds of things.
Really?
Right. Yeah, he went down to Kirkland. There might be a reason behind that. So he ended up down to Kirkland.
I understand. The same reason there was another incident with your good friend Steve LaPlume and his staff sergeant buddy, what's his name? Oh, shoot, he went to the OSI. Palmer.
Oh, I know you're talking about Palmer. Yeah, yes.
Wendell Palmer. They actually had a confrontation, too, I find out. They had two confrontations the same night. First one I responded to, and Williams came out, too, because he asked me to call him if it ever came back. And even Bill Sawyer and his family came out. And whatever it was gone. So we all left, and a large object came back. Right. But they wouldn't admit it till they left the base.
Right. What about if? What about getting General Williams and Colonel Conrad there also?
I don't think you'll succeed there.
I don't know. I'm not sure about Colonel Conrad. I met with him once, recently, the last 3 years. But
I broke the code. I wasn't supposed to talk. But they threw me under the bus. They released the memo and they released the tape.
Right. Well, it's interesting. When I met with Colonel Conrad, the only thing he was upset about you was simply that you said things as an officer you shouldn't have said. He never really did say what you said wasn't true. You know, he never said that to me. We talked about that.
No, he knew it was true.
Right.
I didn't say anything classified. I just said, and it's come to light, the British government, the American government knew a lot more about it and covered it up.
Right. Can I ask you a question? I'm curious. Because I got an interesting answer from General Williams when I asked him this, and I've never asked you this before. Is there anything that you know about the incident that's still classified?
No.
Okay.
I take that back. But what I have is secondhand from somebody, and it's hearsay.
Okay.
It has to do with the weapon storage area and things like that. But I have no direct knowledge. All I know is what I've heard from somebody who does not want to be named, and I know who it is, and said something was done and so on and so forth and whatever.
Okay.
But no. In fact, when I left the military, because my position is the DOD IG, I got a very thorough debriefing by two very skillful people, and we talked about a lot of things. You can talk about this, talk about that, but these areas you don't go to. And when they finished, I said, how about Bentwaters and the incident? And they looked at each other and said, what? And I said, well, I was involved in a UFO incident or whatever it was. Can I talk about it? And they said, no matter. I asked specifically. And before I did the Unsolved Mysteries program, I went to my boss, the DOD IG, and said, I've been asked to do a program. What do you think? Of course, he said, sit down. And, you know, an hour and a half later, after I walked him through everything I knew, he said, go do it. Okay. So I did.
Okay.
That's almost surprising.
What I've been trying to tell you for a long time, John, is the tree you're barking up doesn't have the answers. And I can't tell you on the air.
What exactly?
I can tell you.
Okay. Well, what tree am I barking up? I mean,
no, you keep saying the government's doing this and not doing that and won't release this. It's something beyond what you're familiar with and I'm familiar with that's keeping things the way they are.
Okay. All right. Sure. That's why I really do think that see, when you talk to somebody, even on a radio show, it's for half an hour. I really do think two or three or four days should be spent and it should all come out. And maybe we'll walk away understanding better what happened.
Well, your good friend out in the West Coast wants to do something. And I'm certainly agreeable, but I don't want to sit down and fight with Larry Warren.
Okay.
Larry has some serious substance problems, not just one, but multiple ones, according to friends that know him well.
Okay. That's the kind of stuff, I understand completely. I still just think that anyone that had involvement with it should try to sit down and we should all try to work it out. And if a person's not cooperative, then that person can be removed from the group. But, I just think that is to get as many people there as possible to really sit down and have it moderated. And I suggested Leslie Keene to do the moderation. So,
well, she would probably, I don't know if she'd do it or not.
I'm just saying that's what I'm saying. She's neutral.
Yeah.
And I think that
she's real straightforward. It's either black or white.
That's why I think she would be perfect for it. What I think she should be in the middle of it also. But I just think in the long run we'll get more done than we've gotten done in 34 years. So
34 years. Tough.
Yeah, it'll be 34 years in 15 days.
Well, I'm actually enjoying listening to you talk. But a question that came up, John, aimed at you on the message board was, did Senator McCain show any interest at all in the incident?
Yeah, actually, he took the book that we wrote and the copy was requested to the publisher for him to read. The thing that might happen here, and this is as much as I'm going to say because people get all excited, but I want to say this very carefully. They are very frustrated with the way the DOD and the VA is handling my case. And it's coming down to a point of why are they holding this stuff back? None of this makes any sense to them. None of this makes sense to some other people involved in this. They just can't understand it. And at the end of the day, if they end up not releasing my records and continuing to violate the law as far as not answering FOIA questions and then deny my records and everything else, to include this last incident where they said they were going to do something on it and then it got 86 from above a second time this stuff was taken out of the system, that he may actually open up an inquiry. And I say this not as a UFO case, okay? So people need to understand this. He's going to try to look further into why this would be classified. That's all I'm saying, that this would be looked at as why can't this guy get his records and what went on that would lead to this. So he's not opening up a UFO investigation, but they're going to take a closer look at why this is going on, because there's three different senators that have worked on this, and they've all come back the same thing. Go to special operations, your records are classified. So
getting back to the idea.
I did have one comment to that.
Sure, yeah.
In 1992, I believe it was, end of 91 or beginning of 92, I worked with, you know who Senator Byrd was from West Virginia? Probably the second most powerful man in the country at the time. Seriously. Mm. And I was working with a senior staffer, and I won't mention a name. They were trying everything they could to find out what was going on in this regard. And they got stonewalled.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Martin, do you remember who Senator Byrd was?
I don't remember him. I remember hearing about him, but I just don't remember.
He was the most powerful guy in the Senate far and away. When he called, the president took the call.
And he couldn't get through.
He couldn't get through. They did everything. They tried to follow the money trail. They tried every which thing. I worked with him for 6 months or a year.
Now, Chuck, you alluded that there was something above, are you saying above the government? I mean,
that's my personal opinion.
Yeah.
The politicians come, the politicians go.
Hmm. That's right. So, and everything, I've said many times, everything's probably compartmentalized anyway.
Oh, you have no idea how compartmentalized things are.
Hmm. Yeah, and you have some insight on this because you're of the former, weren't you involved? I want to say I was thinking it was the NSA, but it wasn't. Was it the NSA?
No, we did an organizational inspection of NSA and DIA.
Uh huh.
It's one of those things where every door you open, you find three more, but you didn't get through most of them.
Right. Right. Wow.
And for good reason.
Mm hmm.
Can I ask a question?
Absolutely.
I have a question for Colonel, and this is not to attack anybody or anybody else. What your take on the binary code? Do you think they were planted in Jim by this agency, the agencies?
I have strong suspicions that that's the case, but I don't know that. John, I don't know what happened to you guys in the force for sure. Right. I know whatever happened was remarkable and, you know, more than shocking, I guess, and how should I say, life-changing.
Right.
Because I know there was a remarkable change in Jim, because I knew Jim very well, because he was the cop liaison in the command post.
Right.
So I worked with him on every exercise, and you know how often we did that. And
right.
Jim was singled out to become a chief.
Right.
Even Zickler had him, you know, pegged for promotion, and he got shafted.
Right. Right. Now, what do you think on the codes, okay, what would be the reasoning behind planning codes like that?
I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Right, and as integrity-wise, you believe Jim wouldn't make this up, right?
No, definitely not. Not the Jim I knew.
Right, but I mean, I understand that, but I mean, to this day, you've dealt with Jim over the years. You don't think he just made those codes up. Somehow they got planted. You know, he got them in the wrong time.
Something motivated him to write them down or whatever he did. I don't think they were in the book originally, the notebook. But I can't say they weren't. I handled the notebook, but I did not thumb through the back of the book. I just looked at the front part, you know, where his drawings and stuff were.
Right, right. Okay, because I never saw the notebook until I saw the codes, so that's all I can say on it.
But I saw the book, but I didn't see it initially. I didn't see it until years later.
Okay. All right. Because that's the one thing I won't do. People want me to say, you know, he made these up. I don't believe he made them up.
I don't believe he made them up either.
Right. And then my next question is, how did they get there as far as planted in him? Do you think it was with the contact with whatever we dealt with? Was it the government afterwards putting it in there?
Something did it, or someone.
Okay. That's fair. Thanks.
Was Jim ever known to be any type of math person? You know, someone involved with math?
No, not that I know of, no.
Yeah.
No.
Mm-hmm. Going back to, let's just say if you have a summit, someone, you know, was talking about that on the chat room, and they were suggesting Lee Spiegel also, you know, which I think, you know, Lee's a great guy. But, you know, my suggestion would be, my two cents would be, if either one of you would like to hear it, is to have absolutely no recording devices at all. Keep it completely as a verbal situation between you all, and that way, you know, because once there's a microphone in the room, things change, if you ask me.
Oh, I'm well aware of that. That's why I can't say everything I'd like to say on the radio.
I wish you could.
Well,
yeah.
Unfortunately.
Yeah. There is a question up. Directed at you, Chuck. Did you have any question to having any missing time at all?
No.
And
I've been asked that question, and there were enough of us there or in the background. And we were back and forth on the radio all the time, but no, I don't think there was any missing time at all.
And how about you, John? Wasn't there someone stating that you had some missing time?
The missing time thing is interesting. Two things happened, okay? Number one, at one point on the first night, there was 45 minutes where they lost contact with us, okay? And also, when we were coming back in, both Jim and I noticed that our watches were slower than what they were, you know. In other words, it was like 5:15, it was 4:30 on our watch. I can't remember exact times. But as far as saying we had actual missing time, you know, that's, I don't know. But there are a lot of things that different people don't remember, which I find very intriguing. You know, different things at different points that happened, that one person saw it one way, one person saw it a different way, and everything else. And that's why I think it would help for us all to get together and make sense of it.
Well, John, I can say that the people that were left up at the gate, JD and the rest of them, all said that they lost contact with you for 40 or whatever it was minutes.
Right, right, and even
they did tell me that the following Monday, whenever it was, we talked.
Right, and not only that, but Lieutenant Baran said the same thing. He's gone on.
Oh, that's right. He did. I forgot. He did, too.
Yeah, he said that there was 45 minutes. Now, and then there's another big discrepancy that's very interesting that has never been solved. Our first night. Now, Colonel, back me up or whatever you want to say to this, okay? We should never have left the base unless there was a reason why, correct?
Other than to go out to confirm that it was not a crashed aircraft.
Right, and the reason why...
There was nothing wrong with sending you out there to confirm that there wasn't an aircraft.
And the only reason why they thought an aircraft possibly went down because they actually called our radar first and then went from there to confirm or not, you know, whether or not there was radar contact. And that's the information they got at the command post, or not the command post, but at CSC. They actually had radar contact over the air and they lost it. That would be the only reason why, correct?
Well, when I went in the following morning at 5:30, 6 o'clock, I went to the desk to pick up the blotters, like I did quite often. And Crash McCabe was on the desk. And, you know, he said to me, you know, he started laughing when I went in. He's like, you know, it was a big joke. And I said, what's so
right.
funny? And he said, you know, Burroughs and Peniston and Cabanasac were out in the woods chasing UFOs all night, and the lieutenant said, don't put anything in the blotter. I said, what? I thought he was joking at first. I said, what do you know? And then he confirmed to me that you saw lights and went off the base. He called Heathrow. He called RAF Wattisham. He called the tire. He called everywhere he could. So did CSC. And everybody said, you know, nothing. That's what he told me.
Okay. See, that's interesting. Because Sergeant Coffey has confirmed to us that they did actually contact, and they had that there was something on radar and disappeared.
Well, Nigel Kerr told, I think, Nick Pope, among with other people, that because the dates got mixed up, there was a typo in my memo. You know that.
Yeah, the date wrong, right?
Yeah. It's the night of the 26th, the morning of the 27th, whatever. That they did have a bogey or something. Something appeared on the screen briefly. But that, they said it was the night I was at.
So, right. Okay.
Okay. Up on the message board, John, it's a question asked for you. Can you elaborate a little on the hypnosis?
Well, hypnosis to me, and I've always made this clear, what comes out of hypnosis and what I remember is not totally different. It fills in some missing blanks. But, I mean, the interesting thing was both Jim and mine's hypnosis were similar in certain ways about different things, which doesn't mean, you know, that what came out under hypnosis is factual, other than I didn't see a lot of Jim's. I've seen the transcripts. But in mine, there was quite a few blocks where I just went on and talked about stuff. It wasn't questions being asked, and I wasn't being led into things. And it does fill in some blanks, but whether or not what to do with it, I'm not sure. Again, it goes back to why I think that all of us should sit down and try to piece it together. I think that's the best we're ever going to get. So,
now, I don't think any of us can help you with the first night other than the three of you.
Well, right. The three of us would be nice. I'd love to get Ed back. But, I mean, the whole incident, everything that was seen, how we saw it, the way it went, and stuff like that, would help us understand some stuff.
John, the only thing that's foggy in this whole thing that what I've read or looked into is, what can you describe exactly what it was like for you to walk up as far as you did? And didn't you say that you never saw Jim touch the crowd?
Right. I remember the three of us, and see, there's a discrepancy in that. I always remember Ed with me, and when I've talked to Ed, that's what he remembers the same way. But the three of us were together. We kept getting close to something. We couldn't get definitive to where we were right. All of a sudden, there it was. It was right on top of us. And the fact that I hit the ground with Jim and Ed, you know, we were in a line formation kind of spread out. We hit the ground, and the next thing I remember, it was going up and going away. And when all that happened, that's when Jim walked around it and touched it and got everything else that he said happened to him. And I don't remember any of that. You know, I just remember it was there, it was up, and it was gone. And Jim has it as a triangular object. Adrian Bastenza said he saw it at one point as a triangular object on the third night. But the thing is I saw it as what my drawing and my statement that's been released was, you know. So there's a lot of discrepancies. There's a lot of differences, you know, and stuff. And one of the things that I found when I went back there this last time, a couple of times, is where we were and where we ended up, I don't know how we could have covered all that ground.
Really?
Because
wow.
We went clear out to this called some hill. I can't remember what it's called now. But that's where we were. And that's where we came up and looked down onto the coast. And that's something like 4 or 5 miles. And for us to get clear out there and clear back, there's just no way we could have done it in a couple, 3 hours.
I wasn't aware you went that far out.
That's as far as we went. It's in my statement even. We went up on top of a hill, and it was Ed and I together. I remember that. Jim had separated to the left of us, and we could look down, and that's when we saw the lighthouse. I mean, loud and clear, you could see the lighthouse looking down onto the coast.
Did you cross a plowed field after you went past the farmer's house?
Yeah.
Okay, because that's where we were when the beam of light came down.
Right, and we were all wet and everything. We could, I mean,
but the field up a hill and then on over. We just went up the top of the hill and stopped. We didn't go over the hill and further out.
Yeah, we were clear out there about 4 miles out, 5 miles out, because I've gotten different things. And then the other interesting thing, Carl, and I'm going to ask you about this because it was really strange, and I really never did get to explain it to you totally. But when we were over there in 10, two little old ladies showed up. And this one lady was talking about how she went out there with you and a science teacher from the Woodbridge High School. Okay? And you guys were out in the area, and you were interested in a building that disappeared.
A building disappeared?
Well, there was a building where we found the T in the road. We found it over there, and one of the buildings actually was gone. It was there before, and it's gone. It disappeared. It was there the day before the incident, and it disappeared. And she went into description how you took her and this other science teacher out there to look at the area, and you had questions for her. Do you remember any of that?
I remember taking some people out there. I took Conrad and his wife and his two kids, his son and his daughter, out there the following day or the day after. It was on the weekend. I think it was Sunday morning. And I took a couple other people out there, including a British friend that I can't remember his name now. He took soil samples from the indentations, as I had done too. And he called me back later and said, "Aha, I know how you did that. I find calcium carbonate. You guys used plaster and made those indentations." I said, "No, no, no. Jim made plaster casts."
Okay. Do you believe there was more than one site created to fool everybody?
Yes. Some of the cops created another site.
Okay.
But I'm convinced that the first place I was taken was where you guys were, and what convinces me is that when I had the samples analyzed, too, there was calcium carbonate in them.
Okay. Well, explain something to me that I know you dealt with on the sci-fi piece, and I dealt with Jim when I went over there in 10, and we finally, I think, worked out where we were based on the statements and other things. Why do you think Jim is confused on where the site is?
Jim has been back there three or four times with me, and every time except once when we were there with Jim Milio, and I forgot the name of the company, I had to pull my file out, he took us to the wrong site. I guarantee it was the wrong site, and he kept trying to tell because Vince Thurkettle was there. Do you know who Vince is?
I know who he is. I've never met him, but I know. Yeah.
Okay,
I know him well
because I've met him about three or four times over there. Right. And Jim says, "This is where we were." It was just outside the gate and off to the right. And he said,
right,
"This is the way the trees were." And the forester said, "Those trees are only 25 years old."
Right.
So.
Well, there's no way we could have seen from the gate down what we were looking at from where he said. That's where he took me to. He took me to the right.
Yeah. No, I'm convinced because even the next day, when that's where Verano went, and that's where Ray Gulias went.
Right.
Okay. So that, I chalked that up to somebody meddled with Jim.
Okay. Hmm. But, you know, we've never gotten back to what are they trying to cover up if we're admitting we had something like that happen to us? What do you think they're really trying to cover up?
So many people that have been involved in so many incidents have had, how shall I say, threats and things have happened that for some reason or other, they don't want the word to get out. I don't know. But there's obviously a concerted effort of disinformation, as I call it.
Okay. All right.
John, I want to tell you one thing. You somehow picked up I had two tapes. I do. I made one tape that night in the forest. I only had one tape with me and one tape recorder.
Okay.
A year or two later, I sat down and made a very detailed tape, 1982, I believe it was, for Larry Fawcett, and a copy or two for myself for insurance, if you will, in case something happened or I lost my memory or whatever. And that is what the second tape is. And I told somebody about that, and I somehow got to you, and I've had four or five people say, "Oh, you had two tapes that night. Well, I want the real tape." I said, "You got the real tape."
Right. No, I feel the tape that was referred to was the command post tape.
Oh, yeah, that could be, because they taped everything. They had a big reel-to-reel machine down there.
Right. Well, you had told me that night that you were having it recorded through your... officer there that was there. You told me that third night that you were having it recorded through the command post.
Everything that happened in the EAC cell, that's the emergency cell, you know where the controller is.
Right.
Two of them sit in there. Everything that happens in there, every radio correspondent, everything goes on tape, or did.
Right.
Everything.
Right.
If you walked in there and asked for coffee, it went on the tape.
Right. Did you ever listen to that tape afterwards?
No, I did not have access to that tape.
Okay. Do you think that was sent to Ramstein?
That may be the tape that was sent. That could be the only thing, because there was no other tape. There were no good pictures unless whatever Neville's took and Jim took, but Neville's were fogged.
Right.
And he developed them himself.
Right.
He was in a dark room and he knew what he was doing.
Right.
I think he did.
Right.
There's a good possibility that some of Jim's pictures came out.
Right.
That could have gone to Ramstein.
Right. Okay.
I do know from the British now, one of the documents released, that the sink came over not long after the event, within a month, and a copy of my tape was given to him according to the British. and they were very offended it was given to him and not to them.
Right. 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 That was it.
There's a memo from them that says, you know, and they were offended that, you know, they weren't given a copy of the tape.
Right.
John, someone wants to jump back. They keep asking on the message board, so I'll throw this at you. What were the blanks that came out during hypnosis?
Well, the hypnosis, what went on with hypnosis was it filled in possibly some of what I don't remember. And I've been very little of that. A little piece of that tape has come out, maybe an 8-minute clip of it. That was the part where I was filling in the stuff. But I always like to be very careful, and I've always been very careful on this, that just because it came out in hypnosis doesn't mean it's true. It doesn't mean it isn't, but it doesn't mean it's true. And like I said, there's so much stuff that I just don't remember, you know, and that I don't have memory of, you know. And I know it's hurt the case because I won't back Jim up on what he says, but I'm just... always said what I remember, and that's
all you
it.
Can do. That's all you
right.
can do. What about? I'm going to ask each of you individually, or you can both answer.
Let me comment on what Jim just. Or,
oh, sure, absolutely.
Said. I became very good friends with Bud Hopkins in his later years. In fact, when my wife and I would go to New York, we would stay in his place with him, and he walked me through all the material he had and some really remarkable stuff that you guys would love to get your hands on. But anyhow. I asked him about Larry Warren, and he said, the comment, he said, well, Peter Robbins is a friend of mine. Let me just say, induced memories. Interesting, isn't it?
Huh.
I've listened to some of Larry Warren's hypnosis tapes. I have access to that.
Hmm. Any comment on that, John, or should I?
I haven't heard the tapes and stuff, and so no, I have no comment on any of that. And I, like I say, I go back to what I said earlier. I cannot confirm or deny, not that that's the wrong way, but I have no idea on some of the stuff that happened right in front of me with Jim, you know, the way Jim saw it, and I definitely had nothing to do with the part that went on, you know, in the field that Larry talked about. And I said this. Doesn't mean it did, doesn't mean it didn't happen. I don't know. So.
All right, the question I wanted to ask, we have about 7 minutes left or so, and that is, what has it been like as far as, well, I want to say the debunkers or the ridicule factor on this thing, and you can either, you know, answer one at a time there. If you would.
Well, let Colonel Hogg go into that. He's dealt with a lot more of that than I have.
Well.
So.
I have 3 or 4 cardboard boxes full of correspondence, and you name it. I've seen the second coming of Christ. I've been cahoots with the devil, on and on and on. And I just put that all, as I tell John to do, put it in the shelf and don't worry about it. When the question comes up, if you want to talk to someone, talk to them, put it back on the shelf. I don't make it a focus of my life. I wouldn't be talking to you now if more people hadn't come forward and people have been talking, and John and Jim and Nick wrote a book. So that stirred up a lot of interest. I wish I'd never gotten involved, to be very honest with you.
Mm-hmm.
But the whole time I was out there, I kept thinking, oh, my God, why did I ever come out here? Nobody's going to believe this.
Especially when you had to explain the thing, burst, you know, dripping the molten and then bursting into... I mean, that must have been the hardest thing to admit you saw.
And then a laser beam came down.
Yeah, down to your foot.
Oh.
Yeah. But... how about you, John? Have you had to deal with some ridicule about this whole thing?
Well, I mean, yeah, of course. But, I mean, at the end of the day, I mean, when you sum the whole thing up, there's too much stuff showing that something's classified still on it. And why is it classified 34 years later? And the fact that what we've dealt with is unexplainable. And, I mean, so they can have all the fun they want with it. I mean, I went out in that field and dealt with something that I really would like to do my best to get an answer to, both for me, you know, to understand both physically and mentally, because obviously I've got physical problems and stuff. So they can have fun with it all they want, because the guys that were out there know it's the real deal and it's not a joke. So,
right.
I think everybody pretty much on the base accepted the fact that something remarkable happened. Even Gordon Wayne's accepted that.
Oh, no, there's no doubt. I've had several times I've talked to him over the last 3 or 4 years. Matter of fact, he was there last year and met with me the night before my heart surgery and stuff. So, no, there's no doubt they know something happened to us. The question is, who knows more, you know? There's someone out there that has a lot more answers, so.
I agree. In fact, I asked Chuck Matthews, you know who he was. He was USI commander and a good personal friend. Right after it happened, I said, do you have any interest and you want to get involved in this? He said, we have nothing to do with that. We don't care at all, which turned out to be a big lie.
Right.
Wow. Just one other thing. Colonel Hall, when you saw this object, you know, it looked like the blinking eye, you know, going, was that too far away to actually see the shape of the object itself?
The object appeared to be just a glowing object. I didn't see anything mechanical or, you know, that I could a shape that I could discern other than the oval shape. And it definitely moved horizontally, bobbing up and down. It came into the forest, moved through the trees, went back out into the field. It's like it came up to take a look at us or something and then went back out. That's when we moved up to the edge of the field and watched for a minute or two, and it silently exploded. I was really concerned for the people in the farmhouse because at that time there's hedges in front of the windows now, but there's a bank of windows, first and second floor on that side of the house, and it was reflecting brightly off there like a glowing fire.
Wow. Yeah.
Which means it couldn't have been the lighthouse because the lighthouse is way off to the right, not in the coast.
Right, right. Yeah, and, you know, that's another thing you had to put up with I'm sorry, everyone. That's another thing you had to put up with the debunkers talking about that. The lighthouse. You keep hearing about the lighthouse.
Oh, yes, I do.
And
I've gone round and round with Ian Ridpath. I even sat down in the pub and had a drink with him, and we talked about it, and we came to the conclusion we weren't going to agree.
Right, right.
You can't beat ignorance, you know?
Yeah, well, when someone has their mind up, made up, you know, there's no changing it at all. Well, I really hope that we have about 1 minute left here, so I really hope that, you know, I did have a lot of other questions. Just a real quick one. How long did you stay on the base, Chuck, after the incident? When did you leave the base?
It happened in December 1980, and I left in 1984, or 83. I was there for 4 years.
And was the place revisited at all, you know, during the time you were there?
Multiple times, I find out.
Hmm.
Most people didn't admit it, and they'd come forward now.
Wow. So I wonder if there's still sightings going on out there now.
Definitely.
Really? Wow. Interesting. So it's a hot spot, we find out.
I consider it something of a portal, maybe.
Uh-huh. I'm open to that. I mean, well, again, we don't have any answers. Okay, so that's it for the show this evening. I want to thank you both very much. And I'm sorry for a little trouble.
Thanks for having me on.
Sorry for the trouble we had to begin with.
Okay.
Well, it's our pleasure.
All right. So you can listen to, if you miss any part of the show, you can listen to this and a whole bunch of other free podcasts on Podcast UFO. You can also check out the links in our show notes and our on our website, on the homepage. I want to thank everyone for helping out with the show. Alejandro Rojas for the news. Our guests, of course, Colonel Chuck Holt and John Burroughs. Carrie Lloyd Whitehouse for music. Peggy Shunning for managing our Facebook page. And remember to like us on Facebook for all the latest UFO news. We have Bob Salas coming up next week. And you can check us out live right here on the Dark Matter Radio Network. And every Wednesday at 8 to 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. This is Martin Willis saying keep your eyes to the sky.